I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Our commitment to Ukraine will not weaken. We will stand for liberty and freedom today, tomorrow, and for as long as it takes.
President Biden warns the war in Ukraine may continue for a long time as NATO nations vow to increase support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. But China's blasting NATO for adopting a Cold War mentality. We'll get the latest. Then to Cobalt Red, how the blood of the Congo powers our lives. We'll look at how the world's increasing reliance on cobalt for mobile phones and electric cars has had a devastating impact on the Congo.
And as the world now learns of this new Congo horror, the Morrell and Casement and Harris of our time will be summoned to the cause of bringing an end to this vile scramble for loot that is drenched in the blood of the Congolese people that powers our lives.
We'll speak to Siddharth Kara, author of the new book Cobalt Red. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Heads of state from 31 NATO member nations have wrapped up their annual summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, pledging to support Ukraine in its war against Russia for as long as it takes. On Wednesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with President Joe Biden on the sidelines of the talks, one day after he sharply criticized NATO's refusal to commit to a timeline for Ukraine to join the military alliance as unprecedented and absurd.
Put it in simple terms, the moment the war is over, Ukraine will definitely be invited to join NATO, and Ukraine will become a member of the alliance.
Before leaving Vilnius, Biden delivered a major address reaffirming U.S. support for Ukraine to join NATO someday and declaring NATO is now stronger than ever. President Biden's now in Helsinki, Finland, for a meeting with Scandinavian leaders. Finland recently joined NATO, and Sweden is poised to join as its 32nd member nation. Biden's the first U.S. president to visit Finland since then-President Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin at a 2018 U.S.-Russia summit in Helsinki. We'll have more on the NATO summit after headlines. In Ukraine, at least one person was killed as Russia launched a wave of drone and missile attacks on the capital, Kyiv, for the third straight night. The attacks came amidst mounting signs of a crackdown by the Kremlin on leaders of the failed June 23rd mutiny by Wagner Group mercenaries. A Russian lawmaker close to President Putin said Wednesday the deputy commander of Russia's military operation in Ukraine is, quote, currently resting and not available for now. Sergei Surovikin reportedly had advanced knowledge of the Wagner rebellion. He has not been seen publicly since shortly after the failed mutiny. On Wednesday, Russia's foreign intelligence chief, Sergei Naryshkin, confirmed he spoke with the director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, William Burns, in a phone call late last month to discuss the Wagner rebellion and the war in Ukraine. The U.N. Security Council's meeting to discuss North Korea's latest launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile Wednesday in the 12th such test this year. The launch came after Pyongyang threatened to retaliate against alleged U.S. spy plane incursions over its territory. Japan and South Korea's leaders condemned the launch from the NATO summit. The UN is calling for an investigation over a mass grave in Sudan's West Darfur region, which contained at least 87 bodies, including members of the ethnic Masalit community. The UN's human rights chief said there's credible information that the paramilitary rapid support forces are responsible. This comes as peace talks appear to have hit a wall, and as the UN warns, Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war after 3 months of deadly fighting. To see our discussion about Sudan, go to democracynow.org. Guatemala is facing deepening political turmoil as the Attorney General's office suspended the Progressive Semilla Party Wednesday. Just minutes later, Guatemala's top electoral tribunal certified the results of the first round of the presidential election, sending conservative former First Lady Sandra Torres and Semilla's Bernardo Arevalo to the August runoff. Following Semilla's surprise second-place position in June's first round, Torres and her allies challenged the results, leading to a review of the votes. Arevalo is running on an anti-corruption platform. He is the son of Guatemala's first democratically elected president, Juan José Arevalo. In Thailand, the reformist candidate, Pita Limjaroenrat, lost the parliamentary vote to become the next prime minister. His opposition Move Forward party received wide support from voters in Thailand's May election, but he was thwarted in today's vote by the Senate that was appointed after a military coup in 2014. Move Forward has vowed to reform Thailand's lèse majesté laws, which saw people arrested and jailed for insulting the monarchy following mass youth-led protests in 2020 calling for reforms to the royal system. Further votes will now be scheduled to select a leader. Move Forward could decide to advance Pita Limjaroenrat as their candidate again. In India, authorities in the capital, New Delhi, are warning of shortages of drinking water after the city of 20 million people was inundated by torrential rains, forcing the evacuation of thousands of people in low-lying neighborhoods. Recent flooding in India has left at least 22 people dead. Southern Europe is baking under an unrelenting heat wave, with parts of Spain forecast to top 45 degrees Celsius or 113 degrees Fahrenheit. This week, a report in the journal Nature Medicine found Europe's historically hot summer last year resulted in more than 61,000 premature deaths. Here in the United States, multiple tornadoes touched down Wednesday across the Chicago area, including a twister that struck near Chicago O'Hare International Airport, prompting passengers to take cover and disrupting hundreds of flights. More than 112 million people across the U.S. were under heat alerts Wednesday, with more blistering heat in the forecast through the weekend. This is meteorologist Tom Frieders of the National Weather Service.
We're looking at, you know, potential daily records for high temperatures being broken from California to the west through Arizona all the way into West Texas.
Meanwhile, Vermont, which has suffered from major flooding, is expecting major rainfall this weekend. In the Caribbean, marine biologists are warning unprecedented ocean heat is further stressing a coral reef system that's already on the brink of collapse. This week, the Farmers Insurance Company said it would no longer cover properties in Florida, citing increasingly frequent extreme weather and flooding events caused by the climate crisis. Colombian officials said Wednesday deforestation in Colombia's Amazon rainforest dropped by 26% last year as the government worked with former rebels to protect the environment. This follows the release of new figures showing deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon fell by one-third in the first half of 2023. Amidst a government crackdown on illegal miners and loggers, the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and his Colombian counterpart, Colombian President Gustavo Petro, met at a regional summit over the weekend where they pledged to work together to safeguard the Amazon. President Petro said indigenous communities deserve an economy that doesn't rely on extractive industries.
The northern people wiped out the forests and killed the indigenous people. Is that development? Do we have to do the same? Or is there an entirely different perspective opening up? There is another kind of development that has to do with not cutting down the tree.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals AT&T, Verizon, and other telecom companies for decades covered up the dangers of their lead-containing phone cables to workers and the environment. But the companies failed to take action to mitigate or monitor the risk posed by sprawling networks of cables, despite internal reports showing dangerously high levels of lead found in the blood of workers. At least 2,000, though likely many more, lead lead-covered cables remain underwater in soil and in overhead poles throughout the United States. In related news, the EPA is proposing stricter limits on lead dust from homes and childcare facilities built before 1978, as an official asserted there's no safe level of lead. The new rule would deem any quantity of dust in floors and windowsills from lead-based paint as hazardous, requiring abatement. Babies and young children are the most vulnerable to lead exposure, which can damage the brain and nervous system. Several lawyers who had business before the U.S. Supreme Court used the online payment app Venmo to send money to a top aide to Justice Clarence Thomas. That's according to The Guardian, which reports the payments to the aide, Rajan Vasisht, appear to have been made in connection with a 2019 Christmas party held by Justice Thomas. Among those making payments was Patrick Strawbridge, who recently successfully argued that affirmative action violates the U.S. Constitution, and Elbert Lin, who played a key role in a case that saw the Supreme Court limit the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Former White House ethics lawyer Richard Painter responded, "There is no excuse for it. A federal government employee collecting money from lawyers for any reason, I don't see how that works," he said. Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee grilled FBI Director Christopher Wray Wednesday, accusing his agency of politicization as they took issue with Wray's response to the Capitol insurrection, investigations into Donald Trump, President Biden and his family, and the agency's use of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, among other things. This is FBI Director Christopher Wray during a heated exchange with Wyoming Congressmember Harriet Hageman, who accused Wray of, quote, weaponizing the FBI against conservatives.
The idea that I'm biased against conservatives seems somewhat insane to me, given my own personal background.
Christopher Wray is a registered Republican appointed by Trump. The union representing more than 160,000 Hollywood actors and performers is on the cusp of a strike. This morning, a negotiating committee with the Screen Actors Guild voted unanimously to recommend a walkout after talks with a federal mediator aimed at hammering out a new labor contract failed at the 11th hour. Guild President Fran Drescher said in a statement, quote, "The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers' responses to the union's most important proposals have been insulting and disrespectful of our massive contributions to this industry," she said. Hollywood writers have been on strike since May 2nd. Joelle Selner, a writer who joined picket lines in Burbank, California, Wednesday, says a walkout by actors will turn up pressure on big studios.
If SAG goes on strike, they lose their reality and game shows, and they're going to really start to feel it, because right now they've stockpiled scripts and they have things in the pipeline, things they think they can do without writers. And you really can't do anything without actors.
Democracy Now! Employees are represented by SAG-AFTRA, but are covered by a different union contract than Hollywood actors. And longtime political prisoner Mutulu Shakur has died from cancer at the age of 72, just 7 months after his release on parole after nearly 37 years in prison. The stepfather of the late hip-hop icon Tupac Shakur was convicted in 1988 of conspiracy in several armed robberies and for aiding the 1979 prison escape of Asada Shakur, who fled to Cuba. In the 1970s, Mutulu Shakur was part of the black nationalist group Republic of New Africa that worked with the Black Panther Party and Young Lords to start the first acupuncture detoxification program in the United States as drugs flooded their communities.
Come up to the Bronx, dope fiends, hardened dope victims. We would massage their ears and massage their hands and their legs, and we would stand there with our fingers in their ears or in the different points. We'd do deep breathing, and they'd fall right out to sleep and just relax, and then the next day they'd be back for that treatment. And we were detoxifying people off of heroin and cocaine and methadone with acupressure, a lot of love, a lot of commitment to it.
Mutulu Shakur speaking in the Vice documentary, Dope is Death, directed by Mia Donovan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, President Biden warns the war in Ukraine may continue for a long time as NATO nations vow to increase support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. But China's blasting NATO for adopting what they call a Cold War mentality. We'll get the latest.
It's a still life watercolor of a now late afternoon. As the sun shines through the curtain lace and shadows wash the room, and we sit and drink our coffee, couched in our indifference like shells upon the shore. You can hear the ocean roar in the dangling conversation and the superficial sighs, the borders of our lives. And you read your Emily Dickinson, and I my Robert Frost, and we note our place with bookmarkers that measure what we've lost. Like a poem poorly written.
The Dangling Conversation by Simon and Garfunkel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Biden has vowed to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Biden made the pledge after the closing of a major NATO summit in Lithuania, where the military alliance agreed to invite Ukraine to NATO someday, but no timeline was announced. During his speech, Biden drew parallels between the Cold War and efforts today to push Russia out of Ukraine.
NATO is stronger, more energized, and yes, more united than ever in its history. Indeed, more vital to our shared future. It didn't happen by accident. It wasn't inevitable. When Putin and his craven lust for land and power unleashed his brutal war on Ukraine, he was betting NATO would break apart. He was betting NATO would break. He thought our unity would shatter at the first testing. He thought democratic leaders would be weak. But he thought wrong.
After the NATO summit in Lithuania, Biden flew to Helsinki, the capital of Finland, the newest member of NATO. Finland shares an 830-mile border with Russia. While much of the NATO summit focused on Ukraine, NATO nations also issued a communique criticizing China's growing military power, saying Beijing's actions are threatening the security of NATO members. On Wednesday, Wang Wenbin, a spokesperson for the Chinese foreign ministry, criticized what he called NATO's Cold War mentality.
We urge NATO to immediately stop distorting and smearing China and fabricating lies. Abandon the outdated concept of the Cold War mentality in zero-sum game. Abandon the blind faith in a military force in pursuit of absolute security, and abandon the dangerous behavior of disrupting Europe and the Asian Pacific. Do not fabricate excuses for their continued expansion and play a constructive role in world peace and stability.
China also criticized what it called NATO's eastward march after leaders from Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and South Korea took part in the NATO talks. Meanwhile, talks between China and the United States are continuing. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is expected to meet today with China's top diplomat Wang Yi in Indonesia at a meeting of ASEAN, that's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Meanwhile, Biden's climate envoy John Kerry is scheduled to visit China next week. To talk more about the NATO summit, we're joined by Stephen Wertheim. He's a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School and Catholic University, author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. His recent op-ed piece for The New York Times is titled The Tale the West Tells Itself About Ukraine. You wrote that, Stephen Wertheim, before NATO. But tell us what you believe is the tale that is told that is wrong.
Well, the basic story, and it's not all wrong, that is predominant in Western capitals, is that Russia launched its war of aggression, its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of last year for reasons entirely internal to Russia. That is, Russia fears a democracy in Ukraine that's on its border, or Russia is imperialistic and covets Ukrainian territory. That's all true to a large extent. But part of the tale is that the West took no actions that causally contributed to the decision by Russia to launch its aggression against Ukraine. And I think that's simply not true, or that overdraws the distinction. The fact is, yes, Russia has an imperial mentality, especially when it comes to Ukraine. But it's partly for that reason that Russia has been, over the years, so opposed to NATO enlargement and the incorporation of Ukraine, to be clear, through Ukrainians' own choices, into a Western orientation.
So, Stephen, if you could elaborate on that and talk not just about Ukraine, but other former Soviet states and other countries previously aligned with the then Soviet Union that have expressed and an interest, as you say, in joining NATO and subsequently did, and how Russia responded then.
Yeah, so this is a really complicated story, but there was a so-called Big Bang round of enlargement, the second major round after the Cold War that occurred in 2004. And at that time, seven countries joined NATO, including the three Baltic republics that had been Soviet republics, that is, not just parts of the former Warsaw Pact, but in fact constituent parts of the Soviet Union. At that time, Moscow did not react too harshly. It was a time when Vladimir Putin, a new president, was trying to cultivate positive relations with the West, and he thought that there was an opportunity to partner with Washington around the global war on terror, and he could use that to his advantage. But the real source of intense controversy came in 2008 when George W. Bush tried to get NATO allies to agree to give a membership action plan, that is, a concrete plan for Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. And that's when this strange compromise was forged at the summit held in Bucharest in 2008, stating that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, but not giving them a plan or a timeline to actually do so. And I think that's, in many ways, the sort of proximate source of the tensions between NATO and Ukraine on the one hand and Russia on the other hand. Now, leading up to that summit, the guy who's the current CIA director, Bill Burns, he was then the ambassador to Russia, and he warned Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, that Ukraine joining NATO would constitute the brightest of all red lines for the Russian elite, not just Putin. Unfortunately, his advice wasn't heeded. So it's a reminder that many leading officials and analysts have understood over the years that flirting with the notion of Ukraine in particular or Georgia joining NATO would be something that would run a very real risk of causing Russia to take aggressive steps against those countries in a bid to prevent their alignment with NATO. Now, I have to say, looking at the history since then, Russia has reacted very badly. It has committed aggression against Ukraine, and I think it's backfired on Russia spectacularly. When Russia has meddled in Ukraine, Ukrainians have turned further west. But we have to appreciate this whole dynamic of this history in order to create a more stable and peaceful future coming out of this war when it ends, and it might be quite a while before it ends. And by erasing this history of the dynamic between Western actions and Russian actions, that can make us overlook factors that will cause problems in the future. Specifically, bringing Ukraine into NATO or trying to do that is something that could well cause Russia to reinvade Ukraine, or at least give it an excuse to do so after the current war ends. So Ukrainians and many others in the West think that bringing Ukraine into NATO is some kind of silver bullet solution. It's the strongest possible guarantee of security for Ukraine. But I fear that they may be incorrect about that.
Well, Stephen, you mentioned the 2008 Bucharest summit, NATO summit, and you said in a tweet that this summit in Vilnius intended to deliver a, quote, Bucharest plus statement on Ukraine's future membership. But you write, I wonder if it has, in fact, produced Bucharest minus. So if you could explain what you mean by that, and whether what you advocate, namely that Ukraine should be armed and able to defend itself, but not be given NATO membership, isn't that effectively, even if not explicitly, what was agreed in Vilnius?
That's a really good question. I think you could read the Vilnius statement in the way that you have suggested. What actually came out of this summit? So there had been a big push in the weeks and months prior to make a very clear statement about Ukraine getting into NATO and laying out an actual timetable or plan to make that happen. And that is not what happened. The allies, including the White House, tried to deliver Bucharest Plus. They tried to make it sound like Ukraine was coming closer to NATO membership than ever, and that this would be a very real likelihood after the war. And yet, in the process of doing so, they actually revealed that the alliance was split, and they came up with a formulation that's tautological. Basically, the alliance will be in a position to offer membership to Ukraine when allies agree and conditions are met. So that's pretty much true for any country. So in a way, by revealing, by putting pressure on this question, they have revealed that there are very serious hesitations about bringing Ukraine into NATO and no clear agreement on what conditions Ukraine would have to meet. And the White House itself, I think, seems to be putting forward two contradictory logics on this score. On the one hand, President Biden says very clearly, and I think he absolutely means this, that the United States absolutely should not go to war with Russia over Ukraine. And that would imply not doing so not only now, but also in the future. On the other hand, a pledge of NATO membership would be something that, if deterrence fails, would presumably bring the United States into a direct war with Russia. And he's also sort of entertaining the idea that Ukraine just has to meet certain standards, democratic standards, in order to join. So which is it? That hasn't been resolved. It's been punted toward the future. So this drama will go on. But what we did see, to your point, actually come out of the summit was a remarkable statement by the G7 countries promising long-term economic and security assistance to Ukraine. And we can expect that other countries will join this framework. And it's part of creating what you might call either armed neutrality or an Israel model for Ukraine, by which Ukraine can defend itself and it will be well armed and well supported outside of the NATO framework by its international partners. That is the model that actually moved forward in this summit.
Finally, Stephen Wertheim, if you can comment on China. All the attention is on Ukraine, but in fact, that isn't what was actually happening at NATO. There was a lot of sidelining and going after China, and China struck back, calling NATO's eastward march, warning about it, talking about a new Cold War. Now you have Blinken in Jakarta meeting with top diplomat of China, and you have John Kerry going to China. Can you talk about the significance of what's coming out of this?
I wouldn't say there was much that was concrete about China or new coming out of